Father's a keeper.
This is Prophecy Keepers Radio, coming to you worldwide on the internet. Visit prophecykeepers.com today.
Well, hello, everybody. This is your old buddy Blue Otter coming to you from the tops of the Rocky Mountains. This is Prophecy Keepers Radio. The mission of the White Roots of Peace Council through Prophecy Keepers Foundation is to fulfill the wishes of the Hopi, Cherokee, and Iroquois White Roots of Peace Gathering elders of the 1960s in sending their prophetic messages around the world to establish peace through the worldwide realization of our ancient common global relatedness. The transmission of prophecies was prophesied in the Hopi prophecies to occur once the House of Micah, or the United Nations, was built, and later visited by the prophecy keepers, and their further instructions differed depending on whether they were allowed to speak or not allowed. They were effectively barred from speaking at the UN because they were only allowed to speak when no one of importance was listening. Since they were barred from speaking at the House of Micah, their original set of instructions stated that they were to use any means necessary to get their messages out. The original prophecy keepers, elders, are mostly all dead now, themselves stating that Purification Day would closely follow their deaths, but a few adopted sons and daughters still remain to carry on, themselves getting up in age. These prophecy messages are of utmost importance to the future of this planet, when very few survivors of the final Holocausts will eventually meet each other, and the differences between them need to be minimized so that life may go on in a peaceful manner. Prophecy Keepers Radio is brought to you tonight by SecretsOfAnImmortal.com. It's a book by Ben Abba. What if you met a man who was 2,800 years old? What questions would you ask him about history or religion? Would you want to learn his secrets of immortality? Ben Abba went looking for the oldest person alive on Earth today. He wanted to find out from them what they eat and what they do, and to accomplish such a long and healthy life. And to his absolute shock, he located and made contact with a man whose real physical age is nearly 2,800 years old. If you'd like to know more about the story and how Ben Abba found such a remarkable man, and what stories he had to tell about the unwritten history of our Western civilization, visit SecretsOfAnImmortal.com. Our guest this evening is Marcine Quinzer. She's an accomplished artist in many mediums, concentrating on graphite, oils, and acrylics. Her work is at home in Europe as it is in Canada, Hawaii, and other places around the nation. I discovered Marcine because she'd done some remarkable artistic work around the great law, Guyana Shigawa, of the Iroquois. Marcine, say hello.
Hi.
Well, tell us how you got involved with all of this.
Oh, wow. Well, I've been drawing since I was four. And so through all this journey, I ended up meeting a gentleman at an art show. And, of course, he was very tall, shiny, black hair, long-legged, very, very good-looking man. And he walked up, and at the time I was doing wildlife, a number of different things, and he says, "You were really good." He says, "You ought to be doing Indian art." And I says, "Well, you know, I've raised a city girl. I really don't know that much about it." And he said, "Well, I will teach you." And so that started a 15-year association with him. And in the process, shortly after I met him, it was like spirit told me that he walked in the ways of Hiawatha. Well, you know, at that time, the only person I knew that was named Hiawatha was this guy from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poem. And
right.
To find out that Hiawatha was a real culture hero out of the Iroquois Confederacy, which I learned from him because he was Oneida, just grabbed me. I wanted to know more. I wanted to know everything I could find out about it. And so I was really fortunate in that we built a culture center and museum down in a little place called Wyandotte, Oklahoma. And shortly after we opened this, one of the ceremonial leaders brought to us a stick. And this stick, he didn't know what it was. They'd had it for a long, long time. And so he thought it would be best that it be long in a museum. Well, shortly after that, I don't think it was 6 weeks, we got a visit from Jake Thomas and his beautiful wife, Yvonne. They were down from Six Nations, and what in the world ever led them to our little off-the-roadside museum? I will never, ever know. But Jake came in, and he identified our stick as a condolence cane. And
really?
He sat down and gave us a two-hour dissertation interpreting the symbols that were on the cane for us. Yeah, it was just totally amazing. And, of course, what he had to say just wanted me to know more.
And for the folks that don't know, condolence is the process by which Six Nations clan mothers make or create their faith keepers. Go ahead, Marcine.
His lovely wife, Yvonne, left me with several books that she and Jake had been putting together that were all based on the stories, because Jake was also an oral historian up there at Six Nations. And he spent a good share of his life writing down the things that he knew, because he was afraid they would be lost. In fact, I believe Yvonne is still busy trying to archive a lot of his work. And so they left me these stories, and of course I went through these stories. They were creation stories, they were great law stories, they were just fabulous. And the more I learned, the more I wanted to know. And, excuse me, the stories were so inspiring that I started to paint paintings off of them. And I started mounting these in our museum. And in the story, from what I could find, there was a story about a woman. This woman was the first one to accept the good message for the good mind. And it took me a while, but I eventually found out that her name was Jikonsase. In fact, it was Yvonne who gave it to me. And once I found out her name, then it began to open up even more about this woman. Most of the stories I'd found by then simply mentioned that she lived on the outskirts of a village, and that her lodge was one where the warriors could come. They would find rest, and they would find food. But very little was ever said about her. And my curiosity about her grew and grew and grew. And I just wondered, you know, what is she, the luckiest woman in the world to have all these warriors coming through her lodge?
Yeah.
Or just, you know, what's the deal here? And so shortly after I found out her name, I got a hold of the book about Eli Parker.
Mm.
And Eli's sister, Caroline, was the very last Jikonsase of the Iroquois Confederacy.
Now, Eli Parker, you're talking about, he was on President Lincoln's staff. He was the first BIA director, right?
Yes. Yes. The book is called The Life of General Eli F. Parker, Last Grand Sachem of the Iroquois. And this book was published by the Buffalo Historical Society. The copy that I had was in 1919, but I believe that Mr. Parker actually lived much earlier. I think he was born 1830, and so
probably
he lived through the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
And so with his sister being the last Jikonsase of the Iroquois people, I kind of felt like, you know, what he had to say was really important about her. One of the phrases that he said was that her word was law. He also stated that she was the very last of the lineage of Sky Woman. Now, of course, Sky Woman, you've got to go back to the creation stories of the Iroquois, where Sky Woman is pushed out of Sky World by the Sky Chief and is actually the first person on the face of the earth. How the animals go down and get some of the soil from Sky World that had fallen down when she was pushed out of Sky World, and they bring it up and they put it on the back of the turtle. And from there, the landmass that is known as Turtle Island, North and South America, grew from that. And then they placed her down on top of it. Sky Woman was with child And the first child that she gave birth to was a little girl named Lynx. And then Lynx grows up, and Lynx falls in love with North Wind. And together, they produce a set of twins. Now, in most of the stories, these twins are male twins, Sapling and Flint. And I was fortunate enough to find a clan mother of the Wyandotte Nations that told me that she also had a set of girl twins. And so these girl twins would be the ones from whom the Chukwuemseh had come down through in her lineage in order to be the last descendant of Sky Woman. Also, I learned that as the last descendant of Sky Woman, that she was a very honored woman. Because of this lineage, it was like almost like a royalty. She was set apart from the people, and she was taught by the elders. This is a custom known as downfending. And it actually relates to taking the down of a cattail and spreading it around the lodge where the children or a child is kept and being taught by the elders. In this way, they can see who comes and who goes. And the purpose of this is so that these children can be taught the special medicine ways, the special spirit ways, the herbal ways, the animal ways, and it won't be corrupted through other teachings that they might be exposed to if they were still among the people in the villages. And so I found that this is also what happened to Chukwuemseh. And when she was finally of age, then she was brought back to the people. And the curiosity about this last descendant of Sky Woman caused the people to come from many different directions to come and visit with her and talk with her. And they found that her wisdom was way beyond her years. And it came to be that the people would come to her to have their disputes settled and to get her opinion on things that were going on, so that by the time the peacemaker actually found her, she was already participating like a judge over as many as 14 different nations. One of the things that the peacemaker found that was so surprising to him, he had met some Mohawk warriors along the shores of the Great Lakes when he first began his journey in his white stone canoe. And they had told him about the starvation, about the pain and the hurt, and all that was going on that was caused by the wars. And the peacemaker had promised to them that he would bring peace to them. And they thought, what a marvel this would be if he could surely do this. But they told him how desperate the people were. Their hearts were on the ground from all the loved ones that they had lost from the war. And they painted a very bleak picture for the peacemaker, I am sure. But as he got back in his canoe and continued his journey, he came to another land where he got out of his canoe, and as he walked, he saw fields and fields and fields of corn. He saw fields and fields and fields of orchards. And as he looked about him, he wondered about it. He had just heard how the people were starving, how there was no food, how they lacked the abundance to take care of themselves. And yet here, in the midst of all of this, was a people that obviously were not starving. He had found himself in the midst of what was called, what we term anyway, the neutral Wyandottes. And as he was come to the village, he sat outside the village for 3 days. And during this time, elders came from the village to see what it is that he wanted. And finally, after the third day, they escorted him to a lodge that was on the edge of the village. And here there was a path, north and south, east and west, where the warriors would travel through this country. And it appeared that this lodge was right in the middle of the war path, which made things even more curious. With all these warriors coming and going, how did these people maintain their gardens, their orchards, and their fields? As he entered the lodge, the head clan woman there. This is the Chukwuma say. She was known as the Great Peace Woman. And they sit there, and he begins to outline his ideas of peace to her. And at first she says, well, this is a great idea, but, you know, what is the form that this idea is going to take when you bring it to live among men? And he says that it should be like the firesides in the longhouses. For those that are familiar with the longhouses, they comprise many families. And each family has a hearth of their own. They have their own fireplace. And so he told her, this is the way that this will be formed. Each nation will have their own fire in the council. And she says, well, this sounds like a pretty good idea. And she said that she would take hold of it and became the very first person to accept the great law, the good message for the good mind. Now, the Chukwuma had developed a way of diplomacy. And so the peacemakers stayed with her for a while to find out how they had managed to accomplish, to have this neutrality, this way of peace in the middle of all the turmoil that was going around them. And he found that she had carefully negotiated peace treaties with the warring nations. These warring nations would bring to her treaty belts, wampum belts, that would secure the peace between her people and their people. And essentially, the terms of the treaty was that the clan mothers would make sure that any warrior coming through there would receive food and would receive lodging, and that they would, it would be a place of peace, a place of neutrality, so that no fighting, no warring could go on there. But in return, the warriors had to leave her fields alone, had to leave the gardens alone, had to leave the orchards alone. They weren't allowed to fight in them. And so by this form of diplomacy, creating a win-win situation, she negotiated treaties with at least 14 different nations so that the warriors could come back and forth. And from what I understand from one of the stories that was shared with me, there did come a time after the Great Peace was established that there was some dissension. And it was over hunting grounds. And two neighboring families had claimed the same hunting ground, and they were about to come to blows for it. And there was no way that they could get them to sit down and settle and discuss this. And so the Chukwuma became a war chief. And she gathered the women together and marched upon these villages. Now, the ironic thing is there was absolutely no instruments of war. They took only items of peace. But if you place yourself in that village, you can imagine what sight it would be to see your elder women, followed by the younger women, marching upon you because you're no longer in peace. I can imagine they were very ashamed and very embarrassed. And she was able to be able, she was able to bring this conflict to a good end and bring these people back into ways that were peaceful. Many of the stories that I got from the Wyandots, and so those stories happened to vary considerably from those that I were able to get through the Mohawk, Onondaga, the usual places where we get our stories. And so, you know, if what I'm saying is new to people, that's where I got those stories from, was from the Wyandot people themselves. And so the peacemaker spent the time there learning about diplomacy, but at the same time, he taught them about his ways of peace. And I know, Blue Water, you're very familiar with all those teachings to never go against nature, to forgive the past and to good, do good. We call that restorative justice, different forms of conflict resolution, to love one another and to live in peace. all those teachings that makes this such a fabulous, fabulous story. Anyway, I found it so terribly inspiring that I ended up painting nearly 34 paintings from this story, so that I could create an entire storybook of these stories.
And I like to add, they're fantastic. Yeah, you can see them at marcinequenzer.com, marcinequenzer.com if you're online and listening right now.
So that was kind of how I come about this. I was living with this Oneida gentleman down in Wyandotte, and there in Oklahoma, they invite everybody, I mean the whole community, when they have green corn. The Cherokees come, the Delawares come, I mean everybody comes, and the white community is invited. So everybody comes and participates in their green corn with them, and it's a very big celebration. And so this was also another opportunity to see how the great law worked in operation among the people themselves. I was very fortunate in that in 94, I was adopted into the family of Amanda Greenback, who is Seneca and Deer Clan. And then later on, with the museum and the culture center, that my husband and I was running there in Oklahoma, the Wyandotte Nation, through their business committee, made me associate artist for the nation. And this was basically over all the artwork that I had painted about the great laws, and including their history, what they had also available at that time into my paintings and the stories that I had gathered. And so I felt very, very honored to be able to have both of those things happened to me. I fell in love with these people. Their love, their warmth, their taking me in. I was able to serve at memorial dinners. I was just taking in like I was part of the family. And I so appreciated that. And it did just grow such a love and appreciation. I left Oklahoma in 2003 and came back to Boise, Idaho, which is basically where I was born and I grew up. And it just really tore me to pieces to leave the people down there and all their wonderful celebrations and ceremonies, the stomp dances, the powwows. Here in Boise, we have maybe 2 powwows a year. That's not much when you compare it to what you get in Indian country. That's
so you're in Boise now, right?
Yes.
Oh, well, I'll have to get Earth Thunder together with you. She's in Boise. But go ahead.
I'd heard about her, yes. I think that would be good. That'd be great. I'd love to meet her. I've heard about her, but never had the opportunity to meet her myself.
Got quite a story.
So, anyway, in the research, I got a trip out to New York at the invitation of David Yarrow out there, who is an advocate for the Earth Mother, and has been working at creating peace out there. And he'd seen my art on the Internet and invited me out there. And so I went out there and was able to take my art. It showed at St. Marie among the Iroquois, right there at Lake Onondaga in Syracuse, for about 3 months, I believe. And during this time got to meet a lot of really good people out there. The people out there, too, saw what I was doing, and then they added stories and helped me in that way. When I first started gathering the stories, I guess I was naive enough to think that, you know, I'm going to gather the true story. And it doesn't take very long before you realize that this is oral history that could be 2,000, could be even 5,000 years old. Nobody really knows for sure. And that each one of the nations have developed their own stories. The stories come out saying the same thing. You just get some minor differences, like one story might say Hiawatha had 3 daughters, and another story might say he had 7. But it still comes down to the fact that he lost his family due to the sorcery of the wicked Onondaga sorcerer. And yet when it comes time to create the great peace and to unite all these nations. It is Heyanwentha who was chosen to go to this old sorcerer and to ask him to come and join the great peace, to deliver to him this offer to be the head speaker, the faith keeper for the entire nation. And I think it was about this time that I was fortunate enough. I got a visitation from Mad Bear Anderson, who had passed in 83. And he kept me up all night. Three different times he repeated to me how he wanted me to tell that story. And essentially the way he wanted it was for people to stop and think about how Hiawatha felt, how Heyanwentha had felt. He had lost his family. This man he was going to go speak to was responsible for all the devastation in his life, but the sadness that had essentially made him go kind of crazy. And the pain, the suffering, probably the hatred that he held for this man, and yet it was he who had to go to Anadaro and deliver this message. Please join us and we will make you head speaker of the whole nation. And so Heyanwentha had to sit in himself. He believed in the great peace. He believed in what they were doing. He believed that this was the only way that the people would have peace, that they would find abundance and joy and happiness. So he had to look deep inside himself, and he had to forgive Anadaro for all that Anadaro had done. And so as he goes to Anadaro to deliver his message, Anadaro looks up. He sees Heyanwentha, who is his arch enemy. For long ago, before all this started, they had both been Onondaga. But at that time, Heyanwentha had wanted to create peace for the people. But Anadaro, because of his wickedness, and because he was able to rule the people out of fear, didn't want peace. And so he forced Heyanwentha to leave the Onondaga community. And that is how Heyanwentha ended up with the Mohawks. But Anadaro looks up and he sees Heyanwentha. He recognizes him and he sees him coming down the path. Now, there's only two kind of people that come to visit the Anadaro. One are the captives that they bring in, and since he's a cannibal, he has them for dinner. Or the other ones that are so angry and so filled with anger because of things that he's done that they want to kill him. But here he sees Heyanwentha, and Heyanwentha is not fearful. Heyanwentha is not angry. Heyanwentha is smiling. Perhaps Anadaro thought he'd really lost his marbles by then. Who knows what the old sorcerer really thought. But he invited Heyanwentha in, and Heyanwentha delivered his message. And this is where the change in Anadaro begins, when he realizes that the way he's been living his life is not a good way, for he has no friends. Not even his own warriors does he trust. He must always sleep with one eye open, and it is in this way that he knows what his people are thinking and what his people are doing. And many times he has discovered those who had wanted to kill him and instead had made them disappear. So this was quite a shock to Anadaro to have someone come in such a pleasant way that I am sure he stopped and he thought and he considered this. He gave to Heyanwentha that if he would come back in a year, if he would come back tomorrow, which meant in that time a year from now, he would then give them his answer. Now I'm sure that by this time there are four nations that have already accepted to come into this great peace. You have the Mohawk and the Oneida on one side, and you have the Seneca and Cayuga on the other side. Both flank the Onondaga. all four of them had been living in peace for some time. And one of the things that happens when you live in peace is that you have food. You have what you need. But also, the people have time to enjoy each other. And I'm sure that the Onondagas could hear the laughter that would come from these camps, from these villages. And from time to time, I'm sure that they could see that the other benefit of peace is that they had time to create beautiful works of art. When you are struggling to live, when you're fighting the elements and fearful for your life, you don't have time to create beautiful things. Who thinks of beautiful things when you're starving to death? But in peace, they had time to create beautiful things. Even everyday utensils would be carved in their handles or be decorated with paints and dyes. And so as the Onondaga were surrounded with these peaceful establishments, from time to time the people could hear the laughter and they could hear the joy. And I'm sure that it began to work on them. And it came to be that Onondaga became impatient for this great peace to arrive. When it finally became time for Hayanwentha to get his answer, he and the peacemaker got in the white stone canoe and began to row across the Onondaga Lake. But as they did so, they could hear the old sorcerer as he would scream into the wind, "When will it come? When will it come?" But his impatience would only react in the elements of the earth, and the sky would become overcast with great clouds, and the rain would fall down, and the lightning, and the waves of small Onondaga Lake began to toss to and fro until it threatened to sink the little canoe to the bottom of the lake. And so the peacemaker returned to the shore. In a short time, he and Hayanwentha tried again to go visit the old sorcerer. But again, the waves came up, the sky darkened, the wind began to howl, and in that howl, it was as if they could hear the old sorcerer saying, "When will it come? When will it come?" And again, they were forced to return to the shore. So they decided that what they would do is have another council with the Jeconsase, the great peace woman. It was her who had come up with the idea to offer the old sorcerer this position in the first place. And it was her that had come up with the idea to leave the Onondaga to be last to hear this great message, so that in this way the nations around them would also be applying a pressure to come into this great law. So they go to her, and they ask her, "What can we do? What can we do about this? Because we can't get over there to talk to him and find out what his answer is." And so at this point, she gives to them a song of peace. And she tells them, "If you sing this song, it will quiet the rage in his heart, and it will soften him." So as they get into the canoe again, the peacemaker and Hayanwentha start across Lake Onondaga. And again, the storm comes up. See the clouds darken in the sky, and the wind begins to howl. The waves begin to toss the small white stone canoe to and fro. And in the wind, they could hear Onondaga again say, "When will it come? When will it come?" And so the peacemaker begins to sing this song of peace that was given to him. It is a medicine song given to him by the great peace woman. And as he begins to sing it, the waves quiet down and the wind becomes still, and they are able to continue their journey across Lake Onondaga. Now, when they get on the other side, the canoe is so small that the peacemaker now returns for the great peace woman and for the Seneca war chief. And he rows and brings them across Lake Onondaga. And when all are safely on the far side of Onondaga, Hayanwentha and the peacemaker head out to find Onondaga, while Jeconsase and the war chief head toward the Onondaga village to gather in all the people. Now, it's kind of interesting, because while I was out in New York, I discovered that it is thought that they have a village there called Kaninda. And Kaninda actually is buried something like 20 feet under what is now called, I believe, the Emerald Mall. And so it was kind of interesting, but it's right there at the very southern part of Lake Onondaga, clear across from Liverpool. Liverpool Park there. And both of these places were actually man-made mounds. And if you are standing on them during the winter solstice, you'll find that the sun directly aligns with both of these man-made mounds, one at one end of Onondaga Lake and one at the other end of the Onondaga Lake. And so that's kind of fascinating to know that they had calendars based on the sun, the winter solstice there, and they had built these mounds in order to do that. So that's a little side note there that was curious to me as I was out there visiting. So the peacemaker and Hayinwentha continue looking for Onondaga, and they find him out in the swamp. And this swamp is dirty, spooky, and it fits the sorcerer, for the sorcerer has got 7 bends in his body, and he is so evil that he has got snakes that writhe in his hair. And just the sight of him alone is enough to cause fear to the very heart of any person who should look at him. They ask him now, "Will you accept our proposal of peace?" And the old sorcerer said that yes, he would. So they bring him now into the center of the longhouse. Now, as he enters in the longhouse, he's very quick to notice that here is gathered not only his own people, but the leaders of all the neighboring nations. And his first thought is, they're going to kill me, for I am the wickedest and most evilest man there has ever been. That's what they're going to do to me. But as they brought him in, the people circled him. And they began to sing the song of peace. And as they sang it, the Onondaga was healed before their eyes. For his body became straight. His mind became straight. So that he looked like other men. And when it was finished, the Jaconsa say, "There combed the snakes from his hair, in order to make him presentable, that they may be able to officiate and give to him the Gustawin of Horns and give him the official office as speaker of the Haudenosaunee." The story is just so absolutely fabulous, so visual. You know, they say that the story of the Ten Commandments is a great story. But when I compare these two, I think of the Ten Commandments with all its plagues and death and what it took in order for the Pharaoh to let the people go. And in this story of the out of the oral traditions of these people who created the Peace Confederacy, there is only love and peace and good things. And I found the story like a changing factor in my life. I thought, if people from that time, if three people could make such a difference and change the people's hearts, change the people's minds, and create an entire society of peace, a society that had no poor, a society that had no orphans, a society that had no jails. But this is a story that there's a lot to learn from, for there is no civilization in our present day that can equal the accomplishments of these people 2,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, whenever this event occurred. We know that it's true. We have the Hiawatha Wampum Belt. We have the Confederacy, as it is still represented by the sovereign nations, as Six Nations and at Onondaga. So we know that this story is truth.
Let me interrupt you for a minute.
Sure.
This week on cable, I recorded a program called America's First Nations.
Oh, they aired that, did they?
It's a one-hour show. It is interviewed by an Oneida by the name of Graham Greene, who you may know as Kicking Bird, Dances with Wolves. And it explains that the story you just told has been archaeologically and scientifically verified as being true. Do you remember the part of the story when as they were combing the snakes out of Adaho's hair? That there was an eclipse?
Yes.
Well, with modern technology, they can actually wind back the sky, and they know, I think that the date of that eclipse was the only eclipse visible in the last couple thousand years in Finger Lakes region of New York. I believe it was 1138 or something like
45.
That.
1145, according to dating the Iroquois Confederacy by
right.
Barbara Mann and... Oh, the other guy.
and they have found the bones of people that that were cooked and eaten.
Ooh,
and
that's real?
yeah, it's a real story. It's not just a story, and you know, and some people debate, you know, whether or not the Iroquois Confederacy was the inspiration for the United States Constitution, but. You know, Benjamin Franklin said so, and there was one, I believe, Hamilton. But anyway, I'll let you go on. And
George Washington also, they all sat in council with them.
Yeah, they didn't like Washington much after the war. They called him Town Burner.
Yeah, well, that's because after he became president, he sent Clinton Sullivan up through New York and then later into Ohio, where they burned all the villages of the Haudenosaunee, the Seneca, the Tutelo. Yeah, I can see why they would call him that. But yeah, this story, there's different versions of it. Some of the particulars in it, but it still comes out exactly the same in its purpose and meaning. Not only was our Constitution poorly plagiarized from it, but the suffragette movement, the Underground Railroad, the North Star Trail, all of those were also inspired by people who lived near the Onondaga, the Oneida, and Seneca there in New York, and learned how the women held position, the women voted, the women helped with the politics, with the spiritual, and their whole civilization didn't fall apart the way women were told would happen if they were allowed to vote.
Mm-hmm.
So they...
Founding fathers call it a petticoat government, but they left it in. If they left a petticoat government in and got rid of slavery from the beginning, can you imagine how further ahead we'd be?
Yes, yes. In fact, quite frankly, if they would have listened to what the Native Americans had to share, we would be far, far ahead. There's a story from the creation story about the Field of Plenty. And in it, basically, it tells that in the beginning, Great Mystery created everything that we would need for our planet. Everything is created spiritually. And these spiritual thoughts and forms and creations are held in what is called a Field of Plenty. This field of plenty is like a cornucopia, an upside-down tornado that sits down over the earth. And our elders knew that the abundance was already created. All they had to do was say, thank you, thank you, thank you. They prayed as though they'd already received whatever it was that they were asking for. And because the abundance was there, they just needed to manifest it. And so when the pilgrims came, the Iroquois people took to them baskets of food, woven like cornucopias.
Hey, the Continental Army would have starved to death at Valley Forge if it wasn't for the Oneida women?
Oneida, yes. And they were trying to give to these pilgrims the idea of abundance, this cornucopia. But, of course, you can imagine with the difference in the languages and not having any common words, much less common frame of references, because the way that each believed were so different. Your people that came from Europe, a lot of them were from death prison, which I'm sure secures a very ideological lack of everything, or you wouldn't be in debtor's prison. So they bring that thought form with them over to this country.
We, the Cherokee, call them the scum of the Eastern Ocean.
But they weren't able to relay this concept of abundance. And so as the Europeans became more numerous, more and more and more of them believing the thought form of lack, theirs overpowered the thought forms that were already here.
The Hopi, their prophecy rock depicted the different waves of white people that would come, and I guess it was the third wave. And you could differentiate them by the hats that they wore.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they depicted the Spanish because they wore a hat that looked like the back of a horn to a toad. But anyway, they said that I guess the third wave, of people would wear, a hat like Wovoka wore. You know, it's a cowboy hat without any creases and a flat brim, kind of like a Scoutmaster hat. But they said if these people would come with the symbol of the four directions, but if one of the legs was longer than the other, that they would be unbalanced. And it's really interesting because now we have a resurgence of the Church of Mary Magdalene, which uses the old Celtic cross and it incorporates the female and the idea of Sophia. And there's a lot of exciting stuff going on.
Wow. Yes, I know. I know. When I hear people around me getting discouraged, I just wonder what they're looking at, because there is so many fabulous things, so many hopeful things, so many exciting things going on right now that it's a great time to be alive. It's a great time to be a part of all this.
It is. It really is. And as far as background with me and the Great Law, that bear, I didn't know it was Mad Bear. I just had this dream back about 1984. And in this dream, I was seated. There was a table. It was a low table like they use in the Orient. And this man, obviously full blood, full face, and he wasn't good looking, I remember. And anyway, I remember that he had a white stone around his neck, and there was a gold key embedded in the stone. And his name was written in the stone, but I wasn't allowed to remember it until after the dream. Anyway, all he said to me was, when are you going to do something about Gardner Green's genealogy? Well, I was 30 at the time, and been given my Cherokee genealogy when I was about 15 or 16 by my great uncles. And so that next year, I was introduced to a book. Well, it was coupled with another dream. Was eventually led to a book that talked about how the Mormons were originally put on the path to look for an Indian seer, and then Brigham Young screwed that up because by the time they got out to the Great Basin, he just assumed that all Indians were savages. But Joseph Smith was told that if he lived to be 85, he'd see Jesus, and he would have been 85 in 1890, and bada bing, bada boom.
Yeah.
You know, connect the dots. Well, Volca and Jesus, you know, it's amazing.
It's kind of interesting because one of the things I noticed when I was out in New York, because I visited both places, Joseph Smith's homestead is 15 miles from where the great peace woman lived.
Yep.
15 miles.
Mm-hmm. Palmyra.
Yeah, 15 miles. Yeah, Ganondagon.
It really is amazing. Anyway, I was introduced to, David Mononi's adopted daughter, Zula Brickerhoff, who wrote the book God's Chosen People in America. She also wrote The Spirit of Geronimo Speaks. She introduced me to Robert Three Eagles Shrewsbury and to Grandfather Rolling Thunder. And Robert Three Eagles was the sachem of the United Eastern Lenape Nation. And, he lives 4 or 5, you know, miles from me. I see him every other day. But he spent the summer with the Tadaho, I believe, back in 96 or 7. My first steps on the Red Road were at proselyting the Great Law.
Hmm.
Well, listen, we've got 3 minutes left. Go ahead take 2 minutes, and I got to do a brief, a commercial, but go ahead, Marcine. I'm sorry.
We're great. I've enjoyed this discussion. That's great. But anyway, so my love of the Great Law is what has prompted all of this. And I live it, I breathe it, my paintings, everything that I'm working on. Right now I'm trying to develop a school curriculum based on it and trying to write that in such a way that it will be good for any school. And I just feel that there's such a great message there, that such great teachings. I just think the whole world needs to hear it. I really do.
It's true. Well, there's one other thing you and I were talking about. When I read, the only history of the Great Law that was actually endorsed by Six Nations, written by Paul A.W. Wallace, and in that book, he said that the peacemaker's name was Daganoweda, and he said that Daganoweda meant double row of teeth. Well, it's interesting because the Jibarim, known as the mighty men of renown, King David had a regiment of these guys, and they were the same as the Anunnaki. You know, apparently there's good ones and bad ones, but they call them Jibarim. It's where we get the word gibberish from, and so there's some kind of connection.
It's a possibility. You know, there's stories about this teacher clear up and down the Americas. The Cheyenne have got one called Sweet Medicine,
and they
say that Sweet Medicine lived 445 years.
He walks, it's a book called He Walks the Americas. Hey, listen, we got to go. We got 10 seconds left. I want to put in a word for secretsofanimmortal.com. And Don, if you want to go ahead and roll our music, I appreciate you very much. Thank you so much, Marcine.
Thanks, Bluewater.
Talk to you soon.
All righty.
Okay, thanks. This is Bob Smith Radio. Good night, folks.
Let the truth be known to all keep.
Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine men of the Americas, the holy people of Africa, or the present-day Odawahees of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times. From the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Levant, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.